Wissen. Handeln. Der Podcast zur engagierten Wissenschaft.
Welcome to the podcast on engaged science of Die Junge Akademie. How can researchers engage with policymaking? Are there even obligations to become active beyond academic discourses? And what are the dangers of such advocacy? These questions lie at the core of the newly founded working group Engaged Science, Engagierte Wissenschaft of Die Junge Akademie. We are recording a series of interviews both in German and English. Today, we are speaking English with our multilingual guest, Professor Antonio Loprieno, because we want to address questions that have a European scope. My name is Lara Koik. I'm based in Berlin and work on the history and philosophy of medicine.
And I am Astrid Eichhorn, based in Odense, Denmark, and a theoretical physicist. I'm also the current speaker of Die Junge Akademie. And Die Junge Akademie is the first young academy to be included in ALEA, which is a network of European academies. And ALEA is short for All European Academies. Today's guest in our podcast series is Professor Antonio Loprieno, who is the president of ALEA, historian by training and professor of history of institutions at the University of Basel. And our focus today is on institutionalized forms of engaged science, in particular in the European context. So let me jump right in with the first question. At this current moment in time, still in the midst of the COVID pandemic, in the midst of a climate crisis and a biodiversity crisis, is there an obligation, even a moral obligation, for academics to become active in scientific policy advice?
Well, Astrid, you promised to ask me provocative questions, and the first one is probably the most provocative of all, because in fact, by referring to the two main issues, global issues, that we are confronted with right now, the pandemic and climate change, you address actually the very general issue of the place of science in society as a whole, right? So what should the scientist do? Should he or she actually concentrate on his or her work, which is what ultimately they are paid to do? Or should they use their own experience gained through access to science in order to, let's say, make our world a better place, which is obviously also an obligation? And here I can tell you, since you referred to our institutional function, I can, as an historian, tell you that basically, we come from a tradition where the concentration and the focus of the activity of a scientist was seen as solely scientific. And we move in a direction, which I personally applaud, of course, in which we expect more and more scientists to share their experience gained through science with the rest, with the majority of our society. So my first answer is yes, by all means, while keeping in mind, of course, that we can do that only if we are well-rooted in our scientific work, because this is ultimately what we are socially also expected to do.
Yes, thank you very much. I have an immediate question about the kind of very contemporary history of your reply. So do you think that it is nowadays easier to spark the interest of members of the European academies and policy advice than, say, 10 years ago?
Well, Lara, yes and no. Yeah, it's a jein, as one would say in German. Yes, it is easier because science has become, and particularly the relevance of science for political decisions, is now a topic of discussion every day. So, and you read it in the papers and you hear it on TV, how important that is. So yes, there is a more spontaneous, perhaps, incentive, as it were, for scientists to become involved. The no part of my answer is that scientists are still trained, and to a certain extent, even more than in the past, trained in a very punctual, specific scientific mode, which expects them to concentrate on a segment of information in order to improve on it. And that would seem to run against, you know, the expectation to be involved in social issues, because in order to be involved in social political issues, in one way or the other, you have to generalize. And if you want to make a career in science, you cannot generalize. You must focus even more. So this is a little bit the dilemma in which we are. On the one hand, yes, by all means, our society has made us scientists far more involved and expects us all to be. Particularly, I would say, you guys, younger scientists. On the other hand, particularly you guys are in a situation in which, on the other hand, you should concentrate on what you can really do best, which is your own science. And you know, this is part of the interesting situation in which we are now.
A direct question to what you mentioned, that we are trained as specialists, but in order to communicate with society and with politics, we need to be able to generalize. So the typical academic, does she or he actually lack training in order to properly communicate with society and politics? Is that something where we should place much more of a focus on in the education of the next generations of academics?
I went to university and I was trained at a time in which it was already the 20th century. Don't worry, it was not the 19th, but it was even the last portion of the 20th century. But at that time, there was zero expectation in terms of science communication. Zero, right? Actually, there was even zero expectation in terms of science communication within the discipline itself. So I had a professor of my field of Egyptology who used to answer to a question that students would ask, do you think you can afford this question? Okay. And this was 1975. So if you think how far we have gone in this sense, also in 40 or 45 years, I think this is good news. Yeah. Nonetheless, we should not disregard the fact that not all of us are really good communicators. So in some cases, I think we should not really, again, be fundamentalist in our expectation that scientists should become involved in this kind of discourse, because sometimes it's not even in our best interest, you know, to have some of us serve in this function, because they are simply not very good at that. They could even have some negative impact, which we don't want. So I would say the capacity to communicate and to get involved is one of the features that we should identify in our community and use whenever possible, but without being extremist in this expectation, simply because this is not our primary avenue of education, right? And so this is not our primary business. It is an important, but in terms of our own internal hierarchies, still in the best interest of society, a secondary business for us as scientists.
Okay, we will now want to come to some questions that go to your personal biography. And it's actually quite nice because you already mentioned how maybe today's situation differs from the time when you studied. And our first question goes a bit towards your international experience. So you worked in different countries, and through your role as the ALEA president, you are coming into contact with academic cultures in many different countries as well. So we would be interested if you noticed different institutional cultures concerning the relationship between science and society.
Yes, very much so, Lara. I think that perhaps you touch on the most intriguing issue also in the overall topic of science communication, because the history of the institutional rooting of science in our continent, at least, is a history of what I would describe a tripartite history. You know, so let's say, globally speaking, in the British world, in the German, to a certain extent, in the Italian world, and in the French world, there are somewhat different approaches to the question you just asked, and I have observed them in my own professional life. You know, I would say in general, and take it as a generalization, as an institutional generalization, the British educational system favors a more direct involvement in global issues and in societal issues by scientists more than the German educational system, because at the center of academic instruction in the British tradition, there is this concept of education. And education involves both an instructional component, but also, if I may say so, a moral component, a moral societal component. So at the center of the German tradition, there is the concept of Wissenschaft, yeah, which is slightly different from science in English. Now, science in English is usually more reserved for natural or life sciences. Wissenschaft is also my own. Egyptology is also a Wissenschaft from the German point of view. So there is much more of a disciplinary approach, if you will, in the German continental tradition. And this has been an obstacle historically to a more intense involvement by scientists and scholars coming from our central European continental tradition in societal issues. In France, again, there is this tradition of the state-funded engineering schools that have trained people in order to become civil servants, usually in technical professions. So the involvement of science and society is, so to say, programmatically decided at the center of the educational system. So, and these are varieties that I have indeed observed in my professional life. And since, you know, I spent a certain number of years in the US, I taught at UCLA for more than 10 years, I would say the American system is a mixture, as it were, of the British and of the continental European system. Because, as we know, in the course of the first part of the 20th century, until the post-war period, there was a large immigration of German scientists, you know, into the United States that have given a kind of Germanic touch, as a very disciplinary orientation to the American system, more than is the case in the British system. So if you're interested in these historical trends, there's much you can learn from an international academic experience indeed, yes.
Yes, thank you. And could you perhaps tell us a bit more about your personal path into your current very active role in scientific policy advice by academies?
Well, you know, Laura, I will start with an anecdote, which is also part of my own personal biography. Once I was a happy or more or less happy professor of Egyptology at UCLA, and I saw that the position of Egyptology at the University of Basel was advertised. And so we discussed, my wife and I, and she said, oh, well, you know, let's go back to Switzerland. That's wonderful. Yeah. And then I thought, well, yeah, you know, this business with bachelor and master is really terrible. I mean, all these things. I'd like indeed to go back to a honest to God European university with the licentiat and doctorate and all these nice things. Bachelor and master, how horrible. Yes, let's go to Basel. And it really worked out. Now, the fate wanted that the very year that I came back to Switzerland, it was 1999, was the year of the implementation of the Bologna reform. So at that moment, the rector of the University of Basel said, oh, here we have this American who knows everything about bachelor and master. Can you help us implement a bachelor and master at the University of Basel? I said, God, this is really your punishment, right, for having forsaken, right, the original path. So this is to tell you that it was a little bit by chance. But once you become involved in a certain institutional role, you say, well, now, since this is part of my job, I also want to become really interested in it and also to transform it in a kind of science or scholarship itself. And so I became involved, as it were, in academic organization or management, or call it as you will.
Yeah, so in a way, if I might rephrase that, and you can say if I got it correctly, in a way, your perspective on the history of institutions got you into scientific policy advice first within academia, and then you kind of like developed that further.
Very much so, Laura, very much so. That is what I realized and what I still think is a basic component of our recent institutional history, is that academic institutions used to be until, say, if you want to put a date, so until the year 2000, were very much ivory towers. They were very much operating within a self-referential discourse. And for a variety of reasons, a very superficial form of which is the Bologna Reform, they became far more involved in societal discourse. And this is a transformation that has affected all academic systems, in Europe at least, you know, to a certain extent worldwide, but certainly in Europe. And so I became involved in academic management or coordination or science advice at the time in which the entire educational system itself was becoming far more embedded into societal discourse, right? So you can read my own reaction as a prototypical reaction to a movement that was perhaps far broader than an individual one. It was more of a societal one. And once you are involved in that, you say, well, then I also want, as an historian, you also want to understand the situations, the conditions, you want to kind of predict, as it were, what is going to happen. You know, Egyptologists are also potential academic leaders or science advisors, because what they do in their lives is to reconstruct movements of a particular society. Now, it's like a game, as it were, in which you want to position things in such a way that they make sense. The difference is that the ancient Egyptians are all dead, whereas modern universities are, thank God, all alive. But the mechanisms in which you analyze how systems are intertwined are relatively similar. So I thought that to a certain extent, I had a competitive advantage, as it were.
This is very interesting. Did you also perceive some drawbacks with respect to being more engaged within policy advice?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I did. And I think that this is something that I would also want perhaps to share with you as younger colleagues, as, if you will, a piece of wisdom, well, or of lack thereof. It's up to you to decide. Which is that inevitably, the more you become involved in science advice and generally speaking, in scientific discourse within society, the less you can be an active member of your own scientific community. Because, not only because you don't have time, you know, it's not really a question of time, it's also an issue of priorities. You know, the difficulties I have now in discussing with my colleagues, my own, so to say, disciplinary colleagues, is that they have become better than I was, obviously, because they have had the time and the energy to devote to our science. But also, they read the world in a way, in a very disciplinary way, that I have learned not to read the world with anymore. So there is a kind of, if I may call it, philosophical separation that takes place there. So you lose inevitably contact with your own scientific and to a certain extent, which is also, as we know, a human community. So one should be aware of that. The more you generalize your field of intervention, the less you can claim direct connection with your original field. That's the way it is, right? So, and this is something you should all consider, because there's no clear-cut answer, yes or no, but keep in the back of your mind this threat, you know, of perhaps, you know, losing track of your immediate scientific community. And this I consider a loss, because obviously it's something that you also have to have the energy and the internal strength to sustain. You know, I gave recently a talk at a German, I will not say which one, because otherwise it's too identifiable, but a German disciplinary society, kind of keynote address, you know, those things that people in my position are asked to give. And that was on the position of this particular field within the university system. And I basically said, well, you know, this particular field of expertise should also do their own homework, because they are a little bit too parochial and too insular, and they should become more interdisciplinary and discuss, etc. Then the moderator at the end ask me, but tell me, Professor Rupino, can you still show yourself at professional meetings? You know, and then fortunately there was a colleague of mine who laughed and said, yes, he still can, but we know, of course, that, you know, he has other functions. So this is inevitable, and you can only work at it, but you should not disregard this dimension, which is an important one.
I would now like to ask in a slightly different direction. As scientists, should we wait for our expertise to be called upon by policymakers before we provide science-based policy advice? Or should we take a more active role and try to call policymakers' attention to science-based policy advice even if they have not asked for it? What's a good balance between being too active and too passive?
Excellent question, Astrid. Really excellent question. I would say there too, you see, we should perhaps distinguish between business as usual and crisis situation. You know, if you look at the two topics that you designed, in my opinion, correctly at the beginning of our conversation as particularly pressing ones right now, the pandemic crisis and the climate change, we can see a certain difference between the two, because the pandemic crisis is, to a certain extent, a crisis in the more immediate sense. It's something that politicians may want to address because it may be covered within the term of their election. Climate change is an equally relevant, if not even more relevant, issue for our society, but it's less critical in the sense of immediate political positions. It requires more a long-term or a longish term, not as long as we wish, but a longish term perspective. And I would say that here, to perhaps use these two examples to answer your question, in the case of the pandemic, we don't really to ask ourselves the question, because we are directly asked by politicians, what should we do? Whether they do what we say or not is another thing. But we are indeed immediately put on the spot because there is an immediate crisis. In the case of climate change, we should force our opinions in a more direct way, because there's the risk that at political level, the interest might be less acute, right? And so we should sharpen, you know, our voice, because we know that it's at least as important, if not more important. But we also know that it will not be solved definitely within the terms of a legislature or of a government.
Yes, I think that's a good starting point also for our next few questions, where we would like you to reflect a bit on the difference between what we could call institutionalized and individual engaged science, or engaged science through institutions and individuals. So you told us about your own experience in advocacy for introducing the bachelor-master system at your university, but as president of ALEA, which is a network of European academies, you are also very much involved in these institutionalized forms such as SAPEA, the Science Advice Mechanism for Policy by European Academies. Could you tell us a bit more about these differences?
Yes, Lara, this is another very, not only provocative, but also relevant issue, because here too, we can perhaps observe a slight historical trend that is taking place right now. And the trend is that in order to deal with crisis, we observe that less and less, perhaps very institutionalized forms are called upon to intervene, and more there's an individual approach that is being sought. Look, for example, at what is happening now in these times of pandemic. What have governments done? Usually they have not really called SAPEA or ALEA, as much as I bemoan this fact, but they have not done so. They have asked one or two individuals known at the national level, visible at the national level in a particular field, epidemiology or virology or whatever, say, listen, can you tell us now, can you create a task force of your peers who tell us what to do or what the situation is. So I think as representatives of institutions, we should reflect on that, because it means that as institutions, we may run the risk of being a little bit top heavy, you know, of being a little bit slow. Let's face it, let's be a little bit self-critical. All these institutions that you mention and that I am involved in have, since they have precisely this institutional character, they are probably not very adequate to react at an immediate level. They are more adequate for long-term perspectives. At an immediate level, it's probably more what you call correctly the individual side that is being addressed. So probably what we need to do in a position such as ours, of us all who are involved in this field, is to try to strike a correct balance, you know. So we need institutions in order to guarantee continuity, right? So let's support and let's take care. This is why I'm very happy that the Junge Akademie joined ALEA, because this is precisely this kind of intervention into the future. It's guaranteeing that our institutions remain healthy and innovative. But we should also not be disappointed if in reacting to particular pressures or to particular crises, our institutions are not directly called upon. Precisely because they are institutions, they may be sometimes a bit slow. So we should perhaps also in our own institutions cultivate a certain number of individual members that have a particularly visible, if you will, function and that may be called upon to intervene in immediate critical situation. So my solution would be the integration of individualism into the institutions in order to solve a dichotomy that indeed has become evident in the case of the pandemic, and that may become evident also in the case of climate change. You know, so that's why I very much salute those colleagues, usually coming from earth sciences or from environmental sciences, who are in their respective countries and, of course, in their respective academies, very vociferous so advocates of the need to intervene, right? So, and I very much would encourage these individuals to do so also within the frame of our institutions, because this is how our institutional wisdom then is enlarged.
So would this, like earth scientists giving policy advice before you, because you like to talk about like prototypical examples, would that be a prototypical one for a scientific policy advice with which you were particularly satisfied? Or could you give us another example for which you would say, well, that was really a good piece of scientific policy advice that we could take as an exemplar to think more about, like, criteria for good scientific policy advice in general?
You know, Lara, I would perhaps not choose one example, but I would choose a cumulative one. And the cumulative one is what has happened in these last 12 months at the level of dealing with the pandemic. Because we have observed a kind of collateral movement, both at the level of the specific national task forces that have been implemented, and also at the level of the, for example, European institutions. No, at the level, since you mentioned SAPEA has already had two rounds of recommendations to the European Commission on issues of how to react to the pandemic crisis, precisely gaining in a productive way from the experience of all the national levels. And there is a third one, I can announce it. Well, Astrid, who is involved also at the level of the Junge Akademie, knows that. So we are now in the process of selecting a group of specialists for SAPEA, who is actually going to devote themselves to the issue of preparedness to crisis, to future any potential crisis that might affect European institutions. This is absolutely wonderful. This is great because we are able really to draw on the potential expertise at the international level, but do it in such a way that it will be based on individual expertise, but embedded into a larger whole. Now, I want, since I'm being so enthusiastic, I also want now, as is proper for science and scholarship, also to be a little bit self-critical. We should also see the problems that we as scientists have had in dealing with the pandemic or in the policy advice at the level of the pandemic. Because we as scientists know that in science there are no truths and lies. There are probabilities and likelihoods and less likelihoods. So when we know that when we are asked at the general level whether this is white or black, deep down we know that there's nothing completely, completely white, right? Now, if we say this, of course, this may be misinterpreted also as fake news if it's not translated in the correct way. And this is here where you see, I think we as scientists have also learned through the pandemic to be a little bit more prudent, you know, in how we formulate things. While there is a clear-cut distinction between science and fake news, within science, there's a spectrum of options of probabilities that we as scientists understand, but needs to be translated with extreme care for the public opinion. Otherwise, it may lead to disappointment, deception, disinformation, and all conspiracy theories and all the things we see sometimes around us. So let's keep in mind all these different dimensions that play a role in science advice globally, institutionally, and individually.
You mentioned sort of successful examples of scientific policy advice. I'm wondering, first of all, do we need measures to measure what is good or what is not so successful scientific policy advice? I mean, we are very much used to performance metrics and many other aspects of our lives as academics. Do we also need performance metrics for scientific policy advice? And if yes, what would be a good metric? Is impact what matters most, or are there other aspects?
Well, Astrid, you are a physicist. You should tell me. You know, I am a poor humanist sinner, so I'm not so sure I can be very informative in this. So let me tell you perhaps a little bit my overall approach to the possibility of metrics in science advice. The more something is scientific, the more it is measurable. The more something is public, the less it is measurable. So, because it becomes, so to say, contaminated by all forms of communicative difficulties, issues, misinformation, etc. So, somehow we should administer in a correct way this transition between pure science and discursive science, science as it is part of social discourse as a whole. In this sense, I think it's going to be very difficult to have a persuasive metric for science advice, because it is just as difficult to have a persuasive metric for what is good policy as a whole. You know, we know that what is good policy varies according to ideologies. To a certain extent, now we are observing a transformation towards the more identity-based type. You know, so we, in our diverse society, frequently now we are led to believe, which may be correct or not, that truth is also at least so designed, or a contribution to this design, by your own culture, by your own individual identity. So in face of all this variety or all these variables that can intervene, it becomes very, very, very difficult to find a persuasive metric. I personally would say that, and I hope it doesn't sound to you as too defensive an answer, but I think that if one talks about us, that's already a good sign. You see, so my metric would be being as present as possible in public intellectual discourse. And if we are, if our opinions are present, that's a good sign, because it means that at any rate, it will go in a direction which is better than in the direction it would go if it were left to the populists, right? So
in this public discourse that you mentioned, diversity of viewpoints or of perspectives surely matters. And that brings us to the larger topic of diversity in academia, but in particular also in institutions like ALEA. So ALEA, under US president, has initiated a process to include young academies as members. And of course, the Junge Academy is very happy to be the first to be officially included. And similarly, in the future, young academies might be more frequently included also in SAPEA, in the scientific policy advice at the European Union level. So can you share your thought process in a little bit more depth on the reasons behind this change?
I would say that the reasons that prompted me to become very involved in this kind of rejuvenation, if you will, of the academic landscape are twofold. So I will start with a very individual, egoistic ones. And the egoistic reason is that unless we rejuvenate ourselves, academies are doomed to disappear. So I want to state it as a black spectrum at the horizon. And the reason is that historically, academies were the center of the production of science. And more, historically, the centers of production of science have become universities, not academies. So the role that has been left for academies is precisely interface with society. So this should become our unique selling proposition. Because if we maintain our commitment to the production of science as USP of the academies, we are going to be in a minority situation vis-a-vis universities. So this is something that science advice should always keep in mind. Yeah, there's a, in my opinion, correctly so, there's a certain competitive advantage by universities in this domain. So the egoistic reason is, unless academies become more open to the proactive components of societies, and young researchers are definitely a more proactive component of societies, they are doomed to disappear. The more, if you will, so perhaps equally egoistic, but in perhaps let's call it strategic reason, is that I think we are experiencing now a profound change in our entire knowledge setting. So we are in a period of transformation of our collective knowledge. Similar, I can say this as an historian, similar to what happened in 3000 BCE with the invention of writing, or in 1500 AD with the invention of book print. So we are transforming our transmission of knowledge through the digitalization. And I think that it is in our best interest as scientists, and thus in our best interest of society, as society, to have colleagues who have been trained in this new mode of knowledge. And these are you, not me, right? So to really assist us in this transformation, simply so. So I don't want to say that young researchers are like cyborgs, right? That's not what I mean. But what I mean is that you are closer to the intellectual changes that are taking place in our access to knowledge. I can give you an example. You know, knowledge, the typical knowledge of the book print was an authorial knowledge of an author. A book has an author that is responsible for the contents. And social knowledge, digital knowledge, is less authorial, is far more social, as the words say. Wikipedia articles don't have one author. They have a community that authors them. And so you are also far more, younger researchers are far more sensitive and far more competent in dealing with this type of mental transformation that is taking place. And this is the reason why I think there's no other solution but to take increased knowledge of the contribution by young researchers.
Thanks for elaborating on those reasons. Now, one of the possible involvements of young researchers in ALEA is then, of course, within the scientific policy advice. Traditionally, that is also given by more senior researchers, and early career researchers are traditionally not very much included. And very often, this is actually justified as a measure to protect early career researchers and their careers, so not to take away their valuable time for research. Do you think that that justification actually holds up?
I think, Astrid, that this justification holds up if the addressees agree. I'm always very suspicious of good suggestions that the person to whom the suggestions are given doesn't accept, because I always wonder whether they are truly in the interest of the person or not. So I would perhaps phrase it in the way in which I phrased it in an answer I gave you a couple of minutes ago. Yes, there is indeed a tension inherent in being involved in science advice. Indeed, there's a tension, and whoever does that should know that in one way or the other, he or she might have to, quote-unquote, pay it in terms of direct time to research, invitation to a job talk, or whatever you can list them. However, this is something that remains as a warning, if you will, at the horizon. But I am not in a situation to tell you, oh, dear Astrid, you know what? Let me invite a colleague who is 80 years old to my committee because I want you to concentrate on your article. I say, no, it is in my best interest to have you on my committee. Then it's up to you, right, to decide whether you have the time, the energy, the will. But I cannot judge for you. I can only judge what is in my best interest as someone who wants to gather science advice. And in that sense, it is in my best interest to get your advice, even if it's against your own interest as a researcher.
I have a brief question that is perhaps also a bit going into the direction of science politics now, because I think if you say that it's in the best interest of the scientific community at large and also society at large, but that it's also a threat for younger researchers to engage in scientific policy advice, isn't there then perhaps an obligation to say we need to secure more permanent positions for younger researchers so that they can feel more secure in engaging in scientific policy advice?
You see, Laura, it's a provocative question that is also one of these issues that I, if you touch on it, I could entertain you the next 3 hours on that. So it's one of these issues where my wife would say, oh no, please don't answer this question otherwise. So since 40 years, you have been repeating the same thing. Now, what I'm going to tell you, I've not been repeating for the last 40 years, so it's relatively new. But here it goes. The main obstacle to permanent positions for young researchers is not, let's say, the stubbornness of old researchers. It is the tenure principle. It is the fact that the academic community, as the only community in the entire world, has devised a system in which it protects, basically for life, a job in a particular context, in a particular professorial context. Now, the more you protect a job, the less you open up new jobs. Obviously, the quantity of available positions cannot be so increased ad infinitum. And so it should be somehow regulated by the market. But obviously, why aren't there enough stable positions for young researchers? Because the position for old researchers are too stable. They are basically so as stable as an Egyptian pyramid. And that is the difficulty. So if we abolish, and I've even written, so I haven't gotten many positive responses from my intervention, but I still remain By the way, it would be against my own interest as well, since I have a permanent position, not as ALEA president, fortunately for ALEA, but as professor. So the point is, if we had a more, let's say, flexible academic market as a whole, it would be more attractive for university leaderships to hire for particular positions young researchers, offering them a permanent job, which is more permanent than what you have now, the 3 years of a contract, but less permanent than the eternity of another job. You know, so there's a little bit of a remaining fixed to a model of tenure, which made perfect sense in a time where, you know, the prince would oblige you to say something, and which would make sense in North Korea, but not in our countries. And I think we should perhaps be more open towards a flexibilization of the academic market as a whole. And in my personal perception, that would lead to more permanent positions also for young researchers.
So, Antonio, I think indeed we could discuss for quite a while on your call to abolish the tenure principle, and that would be a highly interesting and I think quite provocative discussion. I would like to come back to the question of diversity in scientific policy advice once more. So we already talked about generational diversity. Now thinking of diversity at large in other dimensions. So currently there is a certain amount of, let me call it, gatekeeping in scientific policy advice, because a lot of it proceeds through institutions that are in some sense elite institutions, like, for instance, academies, which are often quite selective in their membership. So can you reflect on the role of this gatekeeping role and in the context of the necessity of diversity? Or is diversity maybe not such an important value? Is it fine that we have this very strong gatekeeping function in scientific policy advice?
All right. You see, here too, I would like to give you, Astrid, more an historical, perhaps, answer. And historical answers are not meant, you know, to hide behind history so that I don't have to tell you what I believe, but it's a kind of introduction. So this gatekeeping function that you correctly describe is actually more on paper than in reality. Because in reality, if you look at the way in which SAPEA working groups are composed, there is a very, very high number of experts that are not members of academies. Now, when I say this, however, I will not hide from you another very important fact, that the academies themselves, as elite institutions, should be very careful if they see that in a SAPEA group there are many experts who are not academicians, because that means that they have not done their job correctly in their own country, right? Because it means that there are ostensibly at the European level experts that, for whatever reason, at the national level, haven't been deemed sufficiently qualified to become member of an academy. You know, so you know very well that the most now visible German epidemiologist, so Drosten, became member of the academy when he became Drosten, right? And which for me is a sign that somehow the German academic system didn't do their job correctly before them. So I would say I wouldn't see it as a limitation of diversity. I would obviously expect the uttermost diversity to be used in the determination of experts. No discrimination whatsoever in the identification of adequate members. Indeed, I would also then take it as a kind of homework for academies. If the number of non-academicians reaches a certain level, say, now go back to your house and decide properly on who you should have as a member.
Thank you very much for your reflections on the roles of academies in scientific policy advice. And we would like to come to our last couple of questions that are about the future of academies as you see them. And drawing on what you told us so far, there could be different aspects of academies that you have also differentiated in your earlier lectures, right? Where you could say that there's on the one hand, like the idea of a protected place for interdisciplinary research, and on the other hand, this idea of a go-to place for getting like scientific expertise of a very high quality to give policy advice. And how do you like balance these issues? And how do you perhaps see that academies are reacting differently to this question in light of the current crisis?
You know, Lara, we discussed during your previous questions about also the distribution of competencies or of roles between academies on the one hand and universities, for example, on the other hand, let alone the political level. If you ask me where I see the future of academies, I also would say that the pandemic crisis has so sharpened a trend or a tendency that existed before, but that is now, in my opinion, so inconvertible that it will determine the years to come. And that is that academies are more and more involved in science advice. So become the agents, as it were, of science in society and political decisions. This is where I think generally I see a niche, if you want to use this term, for academies to really have something autonomous to say. So the community where scientists, if you want to use this term, which is marketing, like the best scientists, all right, whatever that means, the best in terms of the best, but also the most visible, the most socially engaged scientists, so gather in order to guarantee the interaction, the translation between scientific production and scientific application, right, at the political and social level. This is, I think, so the direction in which the most forward-looking academies should look at. And that brings us back also to the question of paying particular attention to the young academies in this direction. I see less the future of academies in maintaining their nature as elitist group of usually middle-aged scientists, you know, who unite, gather for workshops or conferences. That is, that particular role, in my opinion, tends to be superseded now by universities, right? But the translational role between the production of science and the scientific and the social political application of science is what academies, European academies, really should invest the particular energies on in the future.
Can I very quickly ask, because you define the role of academy then very much in this translation aspect, but so where do then the protected places go that we have for a really free interdisciplinary discourse that maybe universities don't provide spaces for, because maybe at many universities, interdisciplinary discourse is directly linked to thought of future grant applications. So where are the protected places where we can very freely engage in an interdisciplinary discourse that is purely curiosity driven and that doesn't have any direct goals, so to say, beyond just pure curiosity?
You know, Astrid, I am perhaps less pessimistic than you are in terms of whether the universities and particularly the funding agencies are not really responding in an adequate way to this inter- or transdisciplinary need. The situation you describe is, of course, correct. The first trend within the university is to take care of the more disciplinary and how do I write the next grant. That is correct. However, you know, more and more at the national, so the most prestigious also funding agencies expect interdisciplinary initiatives by many universities, usually around precisely these global challenges that are present in the world. To give you just an idea. You know, initiatives such as the Excellence Initiative in Germany and a similar initiative that is developing in Austria right now, or the Nationale Forschungsschwerpunkte in Switzerland, go precisely into that direction, in the direction in which you don't have one group that concentrates on an issue, but you have a bundle of universities, of research groups that combine their energies in order to face a global challenge. So I think that, of course, you might say this is always connected to a kind of quote-unquote economic reality, because it's usually for a grand curiosity driven just in order to share a beer or a glass of wine together. Probably not yet, but this may also be a social change, as we all in all. Yeah. So, of course, if academies remain that type of locus where this is possible, I can only be happy. I was predicting the fact that perhaps this is going to be a more unlikely constellation, you know, 10 years from now than it is now.
As member of several European academies and as president of the Network of European Academies, yeah, you see a lot of like different workarounds of these questions in the different academies. And I would like to close perhaps this interview with the question, if you think that the vision that you provided us for the future of academies holds for all the academies, or if you think that there will rather be more of a diversity of approaches throughout the academies, where some might be more disciplinary organized or interdisciplinary organized, and some become more active in scientific policy advance.
Yes, I think indeed, Lara, that there will be always cultural and national differences within academies. And I hasten to say, I'm very happy that this is the case. Yeah, that this is going to be the case. Generally speaking, I would say probably we can have two different visions, you know, in Europe of what type of future academies might have. There are the academies of the learned society type, yeah? And these type of academies, I think they will probably go in the direction that I was describing before, of intervention, of translational transmission with society and of policy advice. But there is another type of academy, take the Austrian academy, take many European, Eastern European academies that are research institutions themselves. And in that case, I think it is very good if they maintain this primarily also hands-on take on science, and that is part of their tradition, and that's wonderful. And I predict that in that case, they will also move towards this interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary function that I was describing before in answering to Astrid's question.
Okay, so thank you very much, Antonio, for taking the time and for your many thought-provoking answers and for being our guest on this podcast. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Astrid. Thank you, Lara. Your questions were far better than my answers.